episode 665 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Valiant Sunday episode, and today I'm going to be continuing the Valiant chronology with Harbinger number 6 from writer Joshua Dysart. We have pencils by Phil Baronis, inks by Andrew Hennessy with Phil Baronis, colors by Ian Hannon, and letters by Rob Steen. You know, going back and rereading these early issues of Harbinger, I'm once again just blown away by how good the series is, by how quickly Joshua Dysart really established the voices of these characters, made them seem realistic, made them seem relatable, really breathed life into them in a way that I don't even think the first Harbinger series did back in the 90s. So I think, and this surprised me, but I think this is my favorite issue of Harbinger of the entire 25 issues. I had forgotten how much I love this issue. I think part of it is because it's narrated by Chris Hathaway. She's kind of our POV character for this issue. And I feel like this is really, in a way, the first issue of Harbinger. You know, on the cover, we have this rise of the Renegades, and it's such a turning point in the series. It's where Pete decides he's not going to just roll over and die. It's where Chris decides, hey, as much as I don't like what Pete did to me, I'm not going to sit on the sidelines and allow my life to be dictated to me, because I at one point knew Peter Stanchek and he made me fall in love with him, and now I'm targeted forever. She takes a stand. She decides to stop playing the victim, and it's really where the team starts to come together. You know, there are eventually five of them, but only three here. But this is the turning point. This is where, as the blurb on the cover says, this is where the Renegades start to rise. And so it's, like I said, it's my favorite of the series. I think it's very emotional. It's very smart storytelling. It's very compelling. And I don't know that anybody could read the story and say, I'm not interested in what's going to happen next. It's so poignant. Josh makes a few pop culture references that are smart. They're intelligent. You know, they have you kind of nodding your head, in that he takes something as kind of innocuous as pop culture, as like song lyrics, and turns it into something a little more profound where you can't help but find yourself agreeing. And, you know, even though this comic was written in 2012 or released in 2012, November 2012, probably written in 2012 too, you know, 7 years ago, 6 years ago, it's still so relevant today. There's still so much of what's happening, the feeling that you have about Chris and her family being disenfranchised, and you know, it's the haves versus the have-nots. In a way, this story is more relevant than ever. You know, we've talked to Joshua Dysart about that several times, about how that really was something he wanted to explore with Harbinger, the haves and the have-nots, and the idea of making an omelet, you have to break some eggs. And Harada's looking to set up a perfect society, a utopia, but people are going to pay the price. People are going to die. And is that cost worth it? So again, I think that the themes that he's exploring or had chose to explore, you know, with no foreknowledge of the future, at least not as far as I know, I don't think Josh can foretell the future. I'm pretty sure he'd be the first to say he has no idea how to predict. But with no foreknowledge of the future, he managed to craft a tale that was really relevant in 2012 and is even more relevant now. So the story starts off when we're seeing a butterfly. This butterfly seems to be hovering around near Chris Hathaway, and she says, the minute I see it, I know it's him. All that destruction. And at first I thought she was talking about the butterfly, like somehow Pete was using this butterfly to fly around and see through its eyes. But what she's actually talking about is the building that Pete destroyed last issue, the flop house, if you will, where Joseph Iron had been hanging out. And as Chris stands outside of it, she says, all that destruction, Peter did this. This is the junkie squat Joseph Irons was barely subsisting in, where I'd bring him Chinese takeout every couple days. I'm Chris Hathaway. I was Joe's last friend. And he and I share something in common that very few people can understand, a history with Peter Stanchek. So it's nice to know that even after Pete kind of abandoned them, you know, left them to their own devices, and granted PRS or Harbinger Foundation was actually supposed to take care of them. And we know how that worked out for Joe, but you know, that was a condition of Peter going with the Harbinger Foundation, that Joe would be taken care of and Chris would be left alone. So it's nice to know, under no obligation of her own, she kept in contact with Joe, and she was trying to help him out, bringing him food once in a while. So she's kind of given us a recap of what's happened so far. She's thinking about how Joe told her that Pete's got these super psychic powers, and she can't help but believe it, because otherwise what happened to her doesn't make any sense. How all of a sudden she just fell completely head over heels in love with Pete, completely consumed by love for him, had no sense of self, had no sense of anything except Pete. She was like literally overwhelmed with the idea of him. And then the PRS showing up and the attack with the helicopter, Pete kind of unleashing his powers and not being able to shut them off. And then Harbinger Foundation showing up and taking Pete away, Pete releasing Chris from her unnatural love for him. And I love how Josh phrases this. He speaking as Chris says, "When he freed me from his spell, it felt like an inflated balloon inside me had popped." That's such a great visual, right? She's talking about the sense of emotional fullness that she had. Again, she was completely filled up with this love for Peter, whether natural or not, whether, you know, induced. I mean, technically, when you think about it, scientifically speaking, love is just, you know, chemical reactions in the brain. And so there's no reason to think that Pete couldn't stimulate the right parts of the brain and have somebody completely head over heels for him and feel completely filled up with him. And so that metaphor of this balloon that's filled and then all of a sudden it's popped and deflated, and then you just feel empty. That's such an apt description of that. And I'm sure a lot of us can relate, and maybe not to that extent, because obviously we haven't been made to fall in love with somebody through some sort of psychic powers. But, you know, anyone who's experienced a great loss, a terrible breakup, or the death of a loved one, you can kind of understand, you know, that feeling of emptiness that you feel. So Chris talks about how all she was left with was anger and emptiness, and that she'd spent a lot of time with Joe over the past few days trying to understand each other and wondering if they were ever going to see Pete again. And now she doesn't know if Joe's alive or dead. You know, she's standing outside that building. She's got takeout in her hand that she wanted to give to Joe. Just looking at it, she knows it was Peter. And now what to do next? And then she notices that on her phone, it's 4:14. Notices a strange woman in the crowd that she sees for just a second. And then all of a sudden, that woman's gone. We recognize the woman, of course, as Ingrid from the Harbinger Foundation. But for Chris, she doesn't know who Ingrid is. All she knows is she looks at her phone. It's 4:14. She notices this woman. And the next time she looks at her phone, it's 4:17. 3 minutes of her life have disappeared. And not only is the woman gone, Chris is standing in the same place, but Ingrid's gone. Everyone else around Chris is also different. So it's like she just lost for it. The world kept moving along around her, traffic, pedestrians, everybody else. But all of a sudden, she just lost 3 minutes. And she knows somehow it's Pete's fault. There's no other explanation. And she says, "At least once a day, I call him a bastard out loud." So as she heads home, not knowing if Joe is alive or dead, not having been able to deliver the food to him, she thinks about how she's noticed that she's being watched. Ever since the night Pete went ballistic, she's been noticing them. It's strangers that she sees at the bus stop or walking their dogs or at the library, just showing a little bit too much interest in who she is. And it has occurred to her that she might be going crazy, you know, kind of like Joe, paranoid, schizophrenic. But ever since Pete came back into her life, it seems like crazy is sort of the status quo in her life. And we see as she walks up her front steps, the wreckage of the house behind her, which was the house that her and Joe and Peter were hanging out in, were squatting in when PRS came and attacked. So she heads inside. Her mother is greeting her and complaining about some hospital bills that they have. The hospital bill is literally $84,000. And we learn also that Chris's father lost his job and his insurance about a year ago and then had a terrible stroke. And so they're not in great shape financially. And Chris is worried and asks her mom if they're going to be all right. And Chris's mom just responds with the platitude saying, "Oh, don't worry, God will provide, we'll be fine." And Chris thinks, you know, if she almost can't muster up any feeling or any emotion other than anger these days. And so as she's walking through the living room, she records or sets the DVR to record Harada giving an interview tonight. For some reason, her dad's a big Harada fan, but Chris herself says, you know, I can't even watch it myself. I don't have the patience for the news these days. It's just another thing to make me mad. And just like looking across the street, she literally can't escape Peter right now. She looks across the street and there's Peter's wreckage staring her right in the face. She has people watching her, time disappearing from her life. You can hardly blame her for being angry all the time, honestly. So as Chris is there looking out her window, we see all of a sudden she's startled from above. Second story of her house, she's startled from above, and it's Zephyr. It's Faith, and she's wearing a cape and a tinfoil hat, or probably aluminum foil, actually, and some kind of a red dress with a belt around it and a big Z on her chest. And her eyes are glowing because she's using her powers, and she flies right up to Chris, and Chris is like, "What the?" And she says, "Are you Chris Hathaway?" And Chris is just shocked, right? She's like, "Oh my God, it's a flying girl." But then very quickly she realizes, well, this has to have something to do with Peter. This is that bastard's fault as well. So then she urges Faith to come inside. She's like, "Quick, come inside. There might be people watching the house." And Faith floats in and talks about cool room and all the books and, "Wow, you must be, you know, really smart to have read all these books." And Chris is like, "You're not going to steal more time from my life or kill me or screw with my mind or something, are you?" And Faith is like, "No way. I'm Zephyr. I'm a superhero. I totally save lives and stuff." She says, "My real name is Faith, but don't tell anyone. It's my secret identity," and sticks out her hand for a shake. And Chris is just arms folded, not quite knowing what to think. And Faith says, "Okay, look, I really need your help with Peter. You've got to put on this hat. I'll fly you there. But Harada's trying to track us, and Pete's not really in any shape to block him. So I made us these hats, these aluminum hats." And Chris is like, wait, what do you mean, Harada?" And so she agrees to go. She actually agrees to go with Faith. Now, Faith has only been using her powers for a very short time, so she's not able to just pick Chris up and fly her there, or use her companion field to allow Chris to fly the way that Faith can now. You know, her powers have, and her control over her powers have grown over time. But in these early days, Faith is, you know, not very strong, doesn't have complete control over her powers. So they basically kind of float in big hops. And Chris talks about how it's really actually amazing. It's kind of like walking on the moon. So they kind of have a girl bonding moment there. And Chris is thinking to herself, you know, even though I'm going to see Peter, I'm actually smiling for the first time in a month. So they get to the old abandoned post office where they're hiding out. And when Chris sees Peter, her stomach just sinks because he's in such bad shape. And it kind of confuses her. She's still angry at him, and she to the point where she can feel the anger radiating off of herself. But at the same time, for a few hours at least, she loved Peter with all of herself, you know, every fiber of her being. And the memory of that love is still there, the echo of it still there. It wasn't real and it wasn't a choice, but neither is the hate that she feels for him. And these mixed feelings are kind of driving her crazy. She's like, I don't know how to feel. So, and she doesn't know what of those feelings is real. So you can imagine how frustrating that could be, especially for someone as intelligent as Chris, someone who's in a way such a control freak. And so Faith manages to arouse Peter. He's you know, pretty out of it, being that he's been so damaged, so hurt. And Faith does mention, yeah, he's actually healed a lot in a very short period of time. He was in a much worse shape than this, you know, when we first got here. So Pete's awake, and Chris starts feeling this new feeling, which is fear, right? She knows that here's this guy that's laying there, and with the power of his mind, he could make her do anything he wanted, and she wouldn't even necessarily remember it. And so that's a fear. Again, it's tapping into maybe what Chris fears the most, which is being out of control, right? Having her actions dictated by someone else, not being in control of her own life. So she just straight out asks Peter, so why am I here? How much more could you possibly bone my life? And Faith's like, you know, I think I'll go wait outside. And Pete kind of struggles to his feet and then gets on his knees in front of Chris and says, I asked you to come so you could kill me, Chris. It's my gift to you. Just end it. Do all those things you said you wanted to do back in the van. I don't have anything to live for. I've done so many bad things. I'm too dangerous to live. And honestly, I kind of have the same reaction that Chris does, which is, oh, please, drama queen, right? It feels a little manipulative. Maybe Pete's being genuine, but Chris even says, shut up. Let me get this straight. Even if I kill you for what you've done to me, I'm giving you what you want. You're saying you want to die. So, like, how selfish are you? And she even says that. She's like, you're easily the most selfish human being I've ever met on my planet. I just want to know one thing. Is Joe dead or what? And Pete's like, "What? Wait, how did you know that?" And that just sets Chris off all over again. She kicks over the chair she was sitting on, and she wants to know if Pete killed him with his crazy powers. And Pete's like, no, Harada killed him to try to keep me in line. And Chris is like, wait a second. What do you mean Harada? Toyo Harada? And Pete says, yeah, you know, the billionaire, he has powers like me and a whole army, and the whole world is rigged to roll his way. And, you know, I thought they were treating Joe right and taking care of him. That was the deal I made. But no, they just tried to use him against me. And so it's a lot of information to take in. And Chris is kind of standing there thinking about it. And in her mind, it makes sense, right? Toyo Harada, tech guru, global philanthropist, richest guy in the world. It seems crazy, but so does what Pete can do. And what Faith can do. And so Chris is starting to believe it. And she goes further and asks Pete, she's like, okay, well, earlier today, I lost 3 minutes of my life. There was a woman that was watching me. You think she's one of his? And he says, yeah, they were probably trying to read your mind to find out if you contacted me. They probably got in your mind, you know, rooted around to find out if you knew anything and then wiped it. And that's why you lost those 3 minutes. And so then she says, and it's probably those same people that are following me, right? And Pete says, nah, that's probably Project Rising Spirit. You know, the guys that attacked me at the house, they're probably looking for me too. So, you know, I'm sorry, Chris. I'm so sorry. And Chris has just had it. She's like, you know what? Stop apologizing. You can't apologize enough. So stop wasting my time. You've jeopardized everything, my life, my family. Like, I wish I'd never met you. And then she asks him, could you make it go away? You could make me forget it, all of it, right? Joe, ever knowing you, all of it. And Pete says, well, yeah, I could. We'll have to be careful because if someone scans you again, they might be able to pick up traces or find out that I had done it. And Chris says, you know what? No, you don't ever get to go inside my head again. Never again, you understand? And all this time she's trying to decide. It's Pete's wreckage. And does she get involved? Does she, in her words, own it forever? Or does she run away here and now? And ultimately, she makes up her mind and says, screw it, let them find me. Let them find you. Maybe they'll leave me alone. And Pete says, okay, Chris, whatever you want. Whatever you want from here on out. And Chris thinks, you know, I should go home. But I'm kind of scared of that lady that steals time and of the people who watch me. So maybe I'll stay just a little while longer. So for all of Chris's hatred and for all of her anger over what Pete's done, she does, in a way, feel safer around him. I mean, he might not have as much power as the forces arrayed against him and against them, but he has some power. He has some abilities, and some is better than none, I think is what Chris is thinking. So she actually goes outside, and she sits with Faith, and they sit through the night. The sun's coming up, and after a while, Chris asks Faith, do you think Pete's a good person? And Faith, you know, ever the optimist, oh, he's totally the best. I mean, I love how she says this. I mean, he is sort of up his own butt a little, but he's the one that made it so I could fly. And he fought Harada, and he fought for Joe. And, you know, I just think he has guilt about stuff and whatever happened between you two. And Chris is it. She's like, wait, he's the one that allowed you to fly? He made it so you could fly? Chris says, yeah, before that, or Faith rather says, yeah, before that I was just another unloved fat girl. And now, you know, I'm something amazing. And Chris says, oh, for me, you know, since the day he showed up, I have felt out of control, weak, like a butterfly in a storm. And I'm tired of it. So back to that metaphor of the butterfly that we, you know, like we saw in the first couple of panels. And again, Faith, ever the optimist, you're not weak. You're so beautiful. You're smart. I saw those books. You're super smart, right? And Chris was like, yeah, I guess I am pretty smart. And Faith says, yeah, I bet you could figure out anything. And Chris is left thinking, well, you know what? Faith is a good name for this woman. And what she's done is she's allowed Chris to help make up her mind. So again, this issue is when these characters really start to crystallize into who they're becoming, right? They're going through a crucible, and we're getting the first inklings of who they are. I mean, Pete has hit rock bottom in a way, and now we're seeing him start to rebuild himself. And he's, you know, although he starts off this issue feeling really sorry for himself, he does by the end sort of give up some of his control. It seems like he's given up some of his anger. His anger has been burned away a little bit by what's happened, and his eyes have been opened to the wider world. And he's just starting on the path to redemption. You know, when Joshua Dysart was on the show, he talked about how Pete felt so bad for what he did. He's it's kind of like he spends the rest of the series trying to make up for it. And you can definitely see the seeds of that starting here. We also get a really good idea of who Faith is, the way she inspires, the way she's really the glue that holds the team together. She's even able to show Chris, you know, who is almost the polar opposite of Faith when it comes to an optimistic outlook. You know, she's ever the pessimist. She's ever the realist, or the just really practical and logical is how she would explain it. But she certainly is a glass half empty sort of person. But we see her kind of make the decision here too. You know, her personality starts to change. Well, not change, but maybe just solidify and crystallize a little bit as well. You know, she's not willing to be helpless. She's not willing to be weak. And she's going to use, she doesn't have superpowers, but she's going to use the abilities that she does have and not sit on the sidelines anymore, not have her life dictated to her. So she walks back inside and she tells Peter, wake up, bastard. I want something from you. And Pete says, anything. Well, Chris wants to rob a bank. And Pete's like, now? She says, yeah, now. And then when we're done, we'll meet again here tonight. They're like, okay, here we go. And Pete says, whatever plan you have on taking the money, turning me over, I don't care, but just leave Faith out of it. And Chris's response to that is, stop trying to be a hero, Peter. It doesn't suit you. Well, you know what? Maybe not yet, but it's the first steps, right? And so they do just that. They go and rob a bank, and Chris is flipping off the camera, the security camera. And as they leave, Pete tells everybody to forget. And I feel like this is, it's a couple of things. You know, Chris wants the money so that her parents will be okay. But in a way, she also wants to kind of stick it to the man, stick it to the system that's put her parents in this situation. You know, when her father lost his job and lost his insurance, and all of a sudden, you know, Flonase is $900 a bottle at the hospital and such. It's just, you know, she's fed up with it. And this is just one more instance of how she can kind of take some power back. So it's late afternoon. She starts heading back home, and she doesn't even have any memory of the robbery. Pete wiped it away from everybody. And she probably has a little bit of time before the authorities are going to, you know, look at the tape and find out who she is. So as soon as she gets back closer to her neighborhood, the watchers, as she calls them, see her again. She makes sure that they see her again. And then Ingrid shows up as well. And when Ingrid gets close, instead of just allowing something to happen, Chris kind of recoils and says, "Whoa, wait, stop. This is about Peter, right? I know where he is. I'll turn him over to you. He'll be at my place tonight. You can have him. Just leave me alone. Leave me alone. I just want my life back." And she's yelling this at the top of her lungs, so that not only does Ingrid hear and see, but the watchers, the PRS agents, have heard as well. So when Chris gets home, she knows that her parents aren't going to be there because her dad had a doctor's appointment, and she doesn't have a lot of time. And so she feels like watching the Harada interview that she recorded for her dad is a gamble, but she feels like she needs to do it. So she watches it, and she thinks about how old and frail he looks near death. But then she thinks about Joe, and she thinks, you know what, if I believe Peter, then I believe that this man can do anything, kill anyone. He's put himself above everybody else. And she's asking herself, what is it? I mean, this guy is beyond rich, respected. You know, he's a philanthropist and up for the Nobel Peace Prize and all this stuff. And in a way, so many people look up to him and see him as a hero. And what Chris doesn't understand is why, because this guy has all this power and gets to decide so much of what happens to the rest of us, to the lower social strata. Why is that heroic when a person with all this power decides for the rest? Why is that heroic? So Chris thinks that it's time for the people with nothing to start deciding what's right. And that's the path that she's decided to take. So she leaves a note for her parents that says that she's out at a Motel 6 and she needs help. Come really quickly. And once her parents leave, it's not long before Toyo Harada and his other agent show up, Stronghold, Ingrid, and Ion. And I love this line from Chris. She's thinking back to when her mother said that God would provide, when Chris was worried about how they were going to pay an $84,000 hospital bill. And Chris is saying how that's a platitude that her mom only relies on when she's really worried. But what Chris prefers is the great philosophical pondering of Joan Osborne. This is the pop culture reference I was talking about. What if God was one of us, right, from that song? And instead of some superior being who lets horrible things happen, what if God is someone else, just like us, one of us? Maybe not just like us. Maybe he's got power that we don't have. But what if he's just the person next to you on the bus, like the song says, right? So, as I said, Toyo, Stronghold, Ion, and Ingrid have arrived. They enter the house, and as soon as they do, we see that Chris actually is there with her, with a laptop open, communicating via the laptop. And she says, "Hey, welcome to my devalued home, Mr. Harada." Again, this is 2012, so economy was not doing too great. And she says, "I've got to say, this is way better than I could have hoped. videoing you in my living room floating and looking about 30 years younger. It's the golden ticket. And she says who she is and that he probably already knows that. And she goes on to say if anything happens to her or her parents, she's going to release this video. And Harad is like, you know, you really can't imagine how in over your head you are right now. He says your gambit ensures no one's safety. And again, that butterfly metaphor, as Chris says, yeah, I'm a butterfly in a storm, but the butterfly makes one of the most arduous journeys in nature. It's true. And so at that moment, Ion's saying, Harada, PRS shock troops are surrounding the house. It's an ambush. Because again, remember that not only did Chris tell Ingrid that Peter was going to be there, but PRS overheard. So Harada asked for a memory bubble around the house so no one will know what happens or remember what happens. And Chris goes on to say, all right, nice to see you. Can see you're busy. My pops is a big fan. See ya. And at that moment, PRS attacks and fires missiles into the house and it explodes. So at the Motel 6, Chris's parents have arrived. There's a backpack laying on the bed. There's a video camera sitting on top of the TV saying, play me. And when they play it, it's Chris. She's made this message for her parents saying, I didn't know how to do this. I know it's sudden, but I've got to go away for a while. You're going to hear bad things about me. Just know they're not true. There's going to be a lot of media attention, and that's important. It's going to help keep you safe. And hopefully one day I can explain it to all of you. The money in the bag's yours, and the house is insured, so that's going to help. But the insurance might hassle you because you're going to have a very wild claim. And her parents are obviously distraught, like, oh my God, what's happening? And her dad says, you know, I don't know what's happening, but I'm sure Chris can handle it. She can handle anything. And Chris goes on to say how much she loves them. And she doesn't want to hurt her parents. And she knows this can't be good for her dad's heart, but it was the only way she could think of to keep everyone safe. So back at the post office, Chris has returned and she's starting that train of thought again. What if God was one of us? What if he's just some kid making horrible decisions because he didn't know any better? And what if God could be taught to be a better person? I love that idea, right? Not necessarily of thinking of Peter Stanchek as God, but you can use that metaphor if you want. But the fact that he has so much power, but he can still be taught. I mean, because that's the thing about Peter, right? He was born with these powers. And in a way, you can't blame him for turning out the way he turned out. He had no one to teach him. He had no one to mentor him. He had no one to help learn how to control the powers. I mean, he lobotomized his dad when he was like 4 years old. It's an awful thing to carry around. It's an awful thing to have these powers and not know how to use them. And the noise and the burden of carrying them around. And yes, he's made terrible decisions, but at the same time, who among us can say we wouldn't have made the same terrible decisions in that unprecedented situation? And so Chris wants to know if Pete can give other people powers like he did Faith. And he says, well, some people, not all people. And Chris says, okay, well, as of now, you're going to stop wanting to die and you're going to start fighting. You'll do it for Joe, not for me. And then she asks Peter, do you want to fight? And he says, you know what? Yeah. Yeah, I do. And Chris starts thinking, okay, here we go. We're going to need help. We've got to find others. But, you know, two days ago, she was filled with nothing but hatred. Her life was a wreck. But now she's got a flying girl and a bastard god who's desperate for her approval. And this is where it all starts, right? It's where the renegades start to rise. And Chris finishes with this thought that having this flying girl and this bastard god gives her something that so very few people in this world really have. It means that Chris has power. And then we get the blurb. Next, Flamingo too hot to handle. So again, I love this issue for everything it brings to the table in terms of a turning point for these kids. You know, so often kids are powerless. They don't have the financial resources or the notoriety or just the ability a lot of times to affect change. And for Chris, with Peter's extraordinary ability, with his extraordinary powers, maybe she will be able to affect change. She really is a very intelligent character. It's not that she's without her flaws. It's not that she's some genius who has all the answers, but she has a certain point of view. It's the point of view of a lot of people who get stepped on in this world, right? Who are tired of getting the short end of the stick because of the way the system is rigged against them. And having power and being able to affect change, she's not looking at it as something where, hey, I'm going to make the world a better place. It's not that noble necessarily. And in these early stages, you kind of feel like she doesn't even necessarily know what she's going to do with this power. For now, it's enough to know that she has it and she's going to use it. And the first thing she's going to use it for is to stop being a victim, right? The first thing to do is to stop being dictated to stop having people watching her and losing moments of her life. That's the first thing, to get out from under. And then where they go from there, how they take on Harada, all that is still sort of up in the air and we'll be along for the ride. And things don't always go easy and they don't always go smooth. But at least the Renegades become a family in a way. And they're on their own and they're in control of their own lives. You know, Harada doesn't run them. PRS doesn't run them. They, although they're young, they have the ability to have some freedom, to have some freedom and to take back some control of their life. And I really think that ultimately that's what Chris is after, is to be able to feel like she's in control. Maybe a little bit of revenge. And it seems like her hatred of Peter, she sort of shifts that to hatred for the situation rather than necessarily him. I think she realizes that he is broken in a way, right? She says herself, what if God was one of us? What if he was just some kid making horrible decisions because he didn't know any better, right? Pete's made these horrible decisions, but again, he didn't have anyone to teach him. He didn't have anyone to love him and to bond with him. Even his mother abandoned him after what happened with his father. So, you know, I'm not making excuses for the terrible things that Peter has done, but if he could be taught to be a better person, like Chris is saying, then what could be accomplished, right? And so Chris is hoping that she has the intelligence and the bravery and the wherewithal to help inspire Peter and to set him on the right path. Because she wants to take back control of her life. And I think on some level she wants revenge on the system that's made her powerless. And so, you know, that last line of the book, you know, she has what very few people have in this world, power to affect change, possibly, but power to at least take back control of her life and maybe get revenge on the system in a way. So again, a really, really great issue. My favorite of the series, because it's a real turning point. The art from Phil Baronis is pretty strong. I like it better than the Kari Evans art, just because I don't really care for the way Kari Evans draws faces, like I've talked about before. That being said, this isn't the best Phil Baronis art I've seen. I think this is pretty early in his career. I think he's gotten better at anatomy and facial expressions himself, but great storytelling. Storytelling is really solid. Valiant books are never really like flashy in terms of like panel layouts and things like that. So all that stuff's pretty standard, and which is fine. The real strength of the story is the narrative and the voices that the Joshua Dysart is giving these characters. As I said, issue 6 is where the Renegades, Peter, Chris, and Faith, where their personalities really start to kind of solidify, and you start getting a really good idea of who they are. And again, I just love the idea of the metaphor of Pete as a broken god. It's really, really cool. So, highly recommend this series. And as great as the first five issues are, and they kind of set up, get a good idea of who Toyo Harada is, a little bit of an idea of Pete and the mistakes he's made. Really right here with issue six is where the story of the Renegades really starts. Yeah, I almost could think of those first five issues as a prelude. Like, I think you could give issue six to somebody as the first issue, and with only the briefest explanation of what happened before, and they would be hooked. I really do think that. So, my favorite issue without question. All right, well, I think that's it for this episode. I want to thank everyone for joining as always. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.